that evening, and thank you for the opportunity to speak tonight. I think I see many new faces, so welcome to our Wednesday night discussion group of Dharma. So I'm following up on last week's talk where Venerable Kokyo was talking about bowing to the three treasures. And one thought I wanted to follow up was about renunciation, and yet I found myself somewhat, when thinking about how to present it, I found myself in some difficulty putting together the word renunciation, the practice renunciation, what it means in Buddhism, you know, and how it connects out to our practice of devotion, which is a practice of this year. We want to look at devotion, and the talks here right now circle around that topic. So I have come to think that I want to leave some time, hopefully plenty of time, on discussion. And first I wanted to present to you a fascicle of the Dogen, the founder of this particular practice lineage, what he says, so some traditional word from the founder, and then I wanted to say some clarifying word about renunciation that's part of this word, and then open up for discussion. So that's my idea. Just come forward. So we're doing this together here. So in this fascicle heart of the way, the founder of this lineage is saying a point. The first he is saying how most precious it is that we have this opportunity to have met Buddha's teaching in this life. And in order to clarify it, we seek out somebody who has a heart of a way. And here he makes a distinction between just people who know about the Buddha's teaching, you know, just like general knowledge, but then the heart of the way. So in order to clarify what that is, a heart of the way or bodhicitta, he's kind of saying, just look for wholesome friends, because it was very hard to clarify. You can't just point to somebody, he has a heart of the way and she doesn't, and all of that. So he would kind of put that in a bracket and said, just, you know, it's kind of complicated, but just keep looking. Then he is also saying, well, it's also up to your desire. Like, it's not just like somebody out there who knows the Buddha's teaching and has a heart of the way. It's very obvious. They have, you know, very famous, or they have a telephone number and a name tag. You know, it's more like you need to look and have the desire for understanding the teachings, and then the other person will come forward. So it's kind of like he kind of puts the responsibility into the court of the seeker, the true seeker, the person who wants to know how to be happy, how to be free from suffering. And that praying, he gives power to that and says, if you have that, then you're going to recognize, you know, the teacher, and then there's some story going on, there's some past going on. Then he's saying the most important thing overall, if that's happening or not, is to reflect on impermanence. So impermanence is like really clearly knowing things change, everything changes, and you're going to die. And that's like the part I'm going to dive in later. Just wanted to close up what our ancestor is saying here. He's then saying, in the face of this impermanence, in the face of change, do one hands-on thing. One very practical thing, and that's reciting over and over and over again, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. So very clear instruction, no matter what's happening. And then he goes on for a whole page about how you're going to do that in this life, in every moment. You you remember that I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. In between lives, in the next life, in all the future lives, no matter what's happening, there is kind of a zen, kind of like a focus. There's just this only I take refuge in Buddha. And of course, those of us who have started taking that practice on by, you know, taking refuge, reciting it every morning, taking precepts and so on, we know that this practice also includes to really clarify, well, what is Buddha, what is Dharma, what is Sangha? And that seems to be like a continuous question and continuous clarification process. But the main activity he's pointing out, which is very valuable right here, is to just say, focus on this taking refuge. And here again, there's something I'm going to go into in a minute. And then he's saying three more methods that he's recommending for us, very practical things. First is, in this life, create one Buddha image in this life. Now that we have heard of the Buddha's teaching, take the opportunity, create one Buddha image. It can be drawing, it can be making clay, maybe, you know, chiseling, whatever. One Buddha image. That's our homework. The next homework is to copy the Lotus Sutra. So either hand copy it or copy it, like he was printing it. Like you could actually go with your book to Kinko's and just copy the whole Lotus Sutra and then frame it, put it in some cloth, and then revere it. So both of these things he's saying, create the Buddha image, revere it, create the Lotus Sutra, revere it. So two times he's like this very beautiful instruction of do something very hands-on. Create a Buddha image, revere it, like offer, he was very strict, clear about offer a mat, maybe a sitting mat, huh? Sugar water and candles. Maybe he knows that Buddhas like sweets. I don't know. So this is for the Buddha image, and then for the Lotus Sutra, the offerings he also prescribed, which are flower, incense, boughs, and so forth. So it's very practical here. Make a Buddha image, copy the Lotus Sutra, and the third thing was do sasan with your robe. So that's your precepts robe, and for those who are new here, so that can be either the big priest robe or the lay practice robe that you see people wearing. And that means that this person has taken on the precepts of wholesome actions, and with that, with this vow to abstain from certain activity and to adapt the activity of the precepts, sit with that. So these three activities Dong prescribes. So I found it very refreshing that in something that's like for all of us that I took on the path of meditation and the practice of Buddhism, get like in our school, in this practice lineage, a very refreshing, very straight on instruction advice. The heart of the way is to take refuge, to express our refuge in creating offerings and Buddha images and scriptures, copying the texts, the teachings, revering it, venerating it, making offerings, and sit, meditation. This very practical, clear on path, way, away. So, there was these steps before, and he said it, it's impermanence and the refuge part, that I find maybe sometimes gets confusing. And particularly I found today, it's because that the word renunciation in our English usage of the word, we throw it into the same pot as the word denounce, give up, what are the other words? Surrender is one of these words. And so we have a certain image and we have a certain usage of it already in our English language. For example, right now it's Lent, and so there's a certain idea of like, well, during Lent, I'm gonna, you know, renounce, give up certain activities. For example, using Facebook or eating sugar or whatever. People do various things in that practice lineage of the Catholic school. And so sometimes when we come and we think about this first step to enter the Buddha way, to enter the practice lineage in Buddhism, we also say the first step is renunciation. So we kind of combine that. We kind of think, well, I have to give up something. So here's one of my teachers says about it. Renunciation mind has nothing to do with sacrificing. When we talk about renunciation, somehow we get all scared because we think we have to give up some goodies, something valuable, some important thing. So that kind of mind, we think, like, we have to give up something good. he goes on and says, but there's nothing that is important. So, for example, like, the founder of Buddhism, Shakyamuni Buddha, he had all the pleasures of the world, and then he renounced them. So he renounced them after he saw impermanence. And that's why I'm bringing this up. This is really important. So he saw the signs of impermanence. He knows he's going to die. He knows he's going to go old. He's going to get sick. And so he renounced this pleasure palace. He had like a harem. He wasn't just like, oh, I give this up, you know, do my job of realizing I come back later to it. He was like, I'm like giving this up. I mean, this is like, and he actually wasn't like, oh, how sad, I give up chocolate or something. It was really like, actually like, he woke up, there's stories about him waking up in the middle of the harem and seeing all these other women like corpses. He was like disgusted by it. There was a certain renunciation involved, something like, what are you saying? This is not important. This is actually nothing anymore to pursue. And so it's like, so when Dong was saying here, you know, the impermanence part, and what my teacher is saying here, the impermanence part, to be really clear that we are going to die, and that in the face of this death, we are very clearly making new priorities. We're shifting our priorities. And the shift of priority is anything that I'm pursuing in this world is not important. There's nothing that is solidly existing. That's why it's not important, because there's a certain wisdom in here. That's the wisdom that the Buddhas are trying to pass down to us, and that we only are trying to really understand if we are leaving that behind that we thought is important up to now. Like anything. Like for the Buddha, it was his family. He had a family, had a kid. He had a palace, a kingdom that he was supposed to inherit. He thought it was important, and his family thought it was important for him to do it. And when he realized the reality of death, that hit him so deeply that it wasn't important anymore. And in fact, if you really think of impermanence as it's suggested from our founders, what is important? If we know we don't know what tomorrow is happening and how we're going to be in a year, what is truly important? There's certain shift in priorities that that leaves us somewhat vulnerable, I find. It leaves us raw because we are invested. We already have investments in this life. We are having loved ones, we are having jobs that we love or activities that we like, we have places that we like to go to, we have investments. That's the nature of our being. It's not, there's nobody who doesn't have a certain investment of some sort. And if it's just like the breakfast flakes that they like in the morning, you know, there's something we all have that we invested in and that we pursue. And then to be like, to say, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha, actually really means what it says, which is that's the great awakening is the very thing that I'm looking for. It's awakenings that I'm looking for, and it's the Dharma, the true teaching that I'm looking for, and it's the true awakened ones that I'm looking for. And I'm not going to look anymore for the beach, one of mine attachments, or like certain investments that I have. Like right now in my life, I'm, you know, the idea about like, oh, I'm 40, don't I have to invest in some activity or future that can guarantee me some safe retirement, you know, some safety when I'm old and can't take care of me anymore. And that's very strong, and it, and we all of us have that, because it's, you know, sickness, old age, death is such a very scary thing to face. What's going to happen? And then to hear very radically from our founders of this tradition to say, actually, to just take refuge is enough. Like, no retirement plan, you know? I mean, there's some kind of going the grain kind of thinking that we are presented with, and we are presented with this not only once, because we're turning to all these teachers in all these books and all these scriptures are all say the same thing over and over and over, and that's why I just wanted to talk with you about it tonight. So, and then it's also, of course, because maybe it's hard for us to understand, because things seem real for us. Yeah, this room seems real for us. You know, you and me, these are people, and we take care of each other. Because you seem real to me, why else would I take care of something, right? There's a certain... But the teacher goes on, says, all you have to giving up is actually a vague identity. You realize this is not true, yet it's not the ultimate. So to more and more tune into a view and understanding that all what we experience in this life is dreamlike. Why is it dreamlike? Because it's impermanent. There's nothing that lasts. As soon as we think it's real, we think it's permanent, which we think it lasts, and then we invest in it. But if you really take impermanence to heart, which we are recommended, then things become dreamlike, and with a dreamlike there also comes a certain relaxation. And all of those of us who have a regular sitting practice notice that relief in the sitting practice. You come to your sitting practice and things drop very naturally. Don't even have to do it, they just drop. Like the longer you sit, the more things drop in a way. It's like a very natural process, and it becomes even strained if you wanted to hold on to something. It becomes even like strainful and effortful of trying to like, I gotta take care of this thing, you know. Then it becomes really heavy and effortful and tiring and not joyful. Because why? Because it's changing by itself. We can't keep up with our caretaking. Mothers know that, yeah. There's a certain change. You're like, I thought this was good for you, and now you're like older, and now something else is needed, and now suddenly they're leaving the house. There's a certain change you almost can't keep up with. So the instruction is, don't even think for a moment that you're not going to die. So to really, and not in a morbid way, and this is why it was so delightful to hear these instructions from Dogen, from our founder, who's saying, well, just be creative with it, you know? If awakening is that refuge and you want to keep your mind on this awakening, then do it playfully, you know. Build images of this awakening and recite and copy the teachings of this awakening. You know, there's a certain, you can kind of, if you divest, you know, all our energies and all these other activities, we need something to invest them in. And so all these practical activities are very helpful to, you know, effort our investment in that which is not created, which is not a thing. The Dharma is not a merchandise that's being sold or being presented or presentable, that's being created through understanding or knowledge of any form. It's something that's beyond that realm of creation or decay. And it's there, it's waiting for us, it's a response. And that's why this issue of renunciation mostly also comes with a certain insight or a certain degree. Though in this article, Dogen was describing it. However, for the time being, keep your mind on impermanence. Do not forget that this world is transient and that human life is precarious. But do not be preoccupied with reflecting on the impermanence of the world. Determined to regard the Dharma as weighty and your body and life as lightly weighted. For the sake of the Dharma, do not withhold any part of your body and life. So here in this paragraph, you're just trying, what I'm trying to struggle in this talk, and hopefully to talk with you now, we have a whole half hour about it, that it's a balance. It's not that we're all going to get all depressed about being going to die, you know, that would be too heavy. But it's also not that we forget it, that we just put on the bench and be like, well, I'm going to enjoy my life and when death comes, I will notice it, you know, that kind of like, you know, ignorantly about it. It's, we want to bring it to this moment, we want to merge the awareness of our death with this present moment in which we are having energy to invest in something. And then, if that meets, if that's our life energy, our life force that wants to create, that wants to come forward, that wants to be part of what's going on, and if the awareness of impermanence and change, if they merge together, that's a beautiful flower that's coming to bloom there, that then can go into really trying to question what is awakening, what is it to really wake up, what is it really to, what is this life of coming and going, what are we doing here, you know. So why don't you tell me what your thoughts are and then we can try to meet. And I'm not that I'm having all the answers, it's maybe I'm just sharing the question with you, but I would love to hear what you think. Yes.
So I'm a little confused about Dogen saying make a Buddha image. You know, the Buddha, I thought when he was around, was saying don't make images of me. Mm. Like when you go to Bodh Gaya, you see like footprints or... So yeah. when he's saying make a Buddha image, he's talking like a little guy. That's what he means? And what do you think about that in terms of what Shakyamuni said?
Yeah. I think they go together. To make footprints in a way, as I understand it, there was a certain reference there for, wow, I want to express that this awakening or this Buddha is so big that I can't put a real body to it. And in a way, that's your image of Buddha. I mean, in a way, that is an image. It's an image of your reference and your sense of limitation and of that this knowing that this image is not enough. And at the same time, if we start to revere any image, if it be the footprint, the absence of it, or if you revere the statue, then that's like the same invitation of pondering what awakening is. You know, like you start a relationship, and that seems to be more important than is this statue real or is this footprint, you know, like, because then it's interesting because it's exactly this, like, balancing. What, you know, how much weight do you give to this? And how much weight do you give to your own understanding? So it's more like finding the balance between that's what I think right now, but tomorrow I could think about differently. But right now I start this relationship, and I confess, when I sit in front of my Buddha statues, sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, brass, you know, whatever. And I think, and then sometimes not. Sometimes it's like, no, this is the eye of the world. There's something coming towards me. So it's again always in our own eyes. And I think the relationship of statues in particular just really helps us focus on that. It's like a tool that's very revealing, reflecting back. That might not make sense, but what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, like, I was just thinking about, like, interviews, it's huge. I was thinking, if I was going to make a Buddha statue, I'd have to be huge, you know, because it's so huge. But
it is huge, totally. That's why they do it. Like, Lama Supa is doing this huge Maitreya Buddha statue he wants to do, right, in Bodhgaya. Yes. You heard of that? And I think people have that vision of, like, if I want to, you know, really capture what I'm seeing, then it has to be huge. And then they run into gravity and, you know, money and all these issues that, and then it just becomes what it is. Then it might become just this big. Or
so do you think it is? So you're saying you're okay with that, even though the Buddha might have said, don't do that?
Yeah, I'm totally okay with it, because I really feel the relationship to statues, there's something coming out of it. And obviously in the history it was like, what, 500 years as long, or 600 years, where they didn't do these images, and then it just, the images just took off. Lots of images around. Richard.
I'll follow up that very question when I think. I feel like I'm very drawn to and have a respect and some understanding of renunciation and how beautiful it is, but also how liberating it is, as you're saying, to the degree that even this question of my resistance, let's say, which I share. This is a great question. I, you know, do I want to carve a Buddha? You know, isn't my whole sense, you know, of the inconceivable communion that we were talking about in the bowing? Well, it turns out they're kind of the same. My resistance, if there was any, to bowing, starts to go away when I start to, when I'm free, because I have forgiveness, and I always forget the word, you know, letting go, what's that word, you know, renunciation, you know, that I'm actually free to carve anything I want, or play any music, or do anything, because I'm doing it without attachment, the footsteps, or not the foot, and also not reifying anything that Buddha said, you know, and maybe just as in the act of bowing, there could be something infinite and beautiful, since I'm not going to make it some reified sacred thing. I'm going to learn something in that process. Something maybe very beautiful will happen, the same way that it does in bowing, you know. Enough. It's enough for me.
I love it though. Thanks. Yeah? Do you?
Sounds lovely to draw a picture of the Buddha from within to without, in love and admiration. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, totally. Thank you.
I have a very recent experience of being renouncing something that I realized it wasn't wise to do it. But one thing that Shuso does that I didn't know was every Sunday night I'm to take Manjushri and give Manjushri a bath. Well, I said, okay, and Kokyo tells me this, and he says, by the way, Manjushri is on a piece of cloth. Okay, and I said, this is pushing it a bit for me to take a piece of cloth and walk around with it and put it in some water and, you know, dry it out and bring it in here. And I said, oh, okay, well, you know, it's part of the role to do it. And what I realized, it wasn't the object that I was doing it to. It was watching myself go through and appreciate the offering itself. And it taught a lot about me. I was renouncing the meaning of it by what I was having to watch. And after doing it once, it was like, okay, I think I get this. It's not about what I was watching, but the process, the ritual, the meaning in what I was chanting. Because it was just very strange to me to have to buy into that. But I have a question for you.
Sure, but thanks for sharing. That was great. Thanks for sharing this. That's great. Yeah.
We have a lot of form here. What role do you think the form plays in our practice?
That's a great question. I think that sorry for a long answer. Generally, it's understood that the form is a helps us to just rip open our mind and just really see what's happening, because like you're saying, it's immediately there's resistance coming up, because you're told what to do when and because you're told in such a detail that before I came to Zen, I didn't know I cared about how I have my arms and my, you know, I didn't even pay attention to it. But around here, for example, walking in this hall, it's very much almost prescribed, you know, you hold for walking, you hold it in chashu, it's called like this. And for sitting, you hold it like this. So it's like for the two activities of standing and walking and sitting, so there's a prescription. Probably lying down the same. So for whatever you do, whatever posture in here, that you're being told how to do your arms. And I actually was told, and it's not so much, which I really like, that in Japan, friends of mine were told how to hold your feet, which I would love for people to learn to be aware, where do you have your feet. And so there you are, you know, you're being told how the four extremities are being put. And what it does to you is kind of you're withdrawing your energies inward. This is like an inward, because you have to pay attention to it where they are. And then you need to be aware, you have to be aware of how you feel about it, because it's going to be very strong if you're like being told, because it's not just like for 10 minutes, it's like for, if you're here for Sesshin, it would be like 24/7 for 3 days, you're being told how to hold your extremities. And because I'm this person who actually still struggles and resists that very instruction, I would go with saying that why are we having all these forms is to be to learn to overcome the resistance and relax with our body posture. But then also again, what I find more and more, that if I'm able to step behind this level of resistance, there is this whole meadow of experience that comes out of a relaxation. Like I'm not invested anymore, how I'm having my arms and my legs. I'm not resisting it. Because I'm not invested and I'm not resisting it, I'm just giving it. There's like a giving of my body. And then in giving of my body, then there's a certain bliss that comes out. So from this kind of bliss, joyful event, where I'm not invested in my body's posture in a way, there's some joy that's kind of like that's very grateful. There's a lot of gratitude there of just receiving this life. To be like, oh, I thought I was doing all of this, and now that I'm giving it up, now that I'm not investing in what I'm doing, I'm giving up my form of how I'm holding my body. There's this gratitude of receiving.
Kind of like being done by the forms.
Yeah.
The forms are coming from you.
Yeah, like the forms were like kind of the gateway of overcoming my self-empowered agenda of how I'm holding myself and going into an openness that just receives. Mm-hmm. Just receives and feels like nourished. It's just this, this fountain of, it's a fountain of something way larger that's like, whoa. It's not me anymore. I'm not it, but it is me. Kind of, it is me. So nice to not invest, yeah.
To add to that one, tea ceremony, form, these things to be translated to practice and realization of things like grace and beauty, which don't need any reason. Mm-hmm. But if I have a choice in life, and I know I'm going to die, fine, doesn't matter, doesn't change my choice. I would like to live it gracefully and beautifully. Mm-hmm. And I think form is the practice and realization of grace and beauty.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And which what you were saying, only I like those words, grace and beauty.
Yeah. I mean, this is a, you know, because this place has this place of receiving. These are just, these are like words. Like you, I think anybody, everybody has a lot of words to share, and all these ancestors are trying to tell us words. So grace and beauty, they might have said, coming from this place, or, you know, like the whole Lotus Sutra. Isn't like the Lotus Sutra one big description of something that cannot be described? It kind of admits it from the very beginning. It's kind of saying, just recite the Lotus Sutra, but don't ask me what it is. It's just kind of a certain kind of helplessness that comes along, I think, if you leave your own kind of conceptual story behind of what's going on, then you receive something that has many words and many forms, and then it's beautiful to listen to the ancestors and hear what how they say it, because then it gives material and inspiration for us to come up with words that are like really close to our heart, because we share the same nature and we share. We are the same nature. We are the same bliss. So there's a certain science, you know, once this renunciation came into place, we are letting go. We are really close. We really know we're going to die. We really know we are changing. We are letting go. And this, unconstructed realm opens itself to us. There's joy. There is a non-investment, like there's compassion. Like it's like non-investment in the sense of like, you really don't, if Trump is going to be president, you know, I couldn't care less, you know? And at the same time, we feel the pain and we want to do something to help beings. There is like a certain, there's this kind of paradoxical situation of couldn't care less, and I hear the pain, I feel the pain, I want to help beings for anything. It's kind of this mm-hmm. parallel. These are the kind of the main signs, I would say. Joy, relaxation, couldn't care less. And feeling the pain, being deeply in touch with the pain, and responding with love, responding with care.
You've given us some beautiful images about the culture of Nepal and how Buddhism permeates it. Can you give us any examples how that culture expresses the idea of impermanence and nothing matters as a culture?
It's interesting that you had the association with Nepal. because I didn't have. And but if I think of it, and I heard all these stories, especially now recently, we had this like terrible political situation that just came after the earthquake in Nepal, the earthquake that they had, and the government hasn't been investing in this country for a long time. They have been divesting it into various personal private bank accounts or in their own political agenda that they have. There was a, because of that, there was some blockage of the tribe that was closest to the Indian border. They blocked anything that came into Nepal from India for like a whole month. And the people didn't, it was getting cold and people didn't have anything for cooking, because mostly what was blocked was fuel, the cooking fuel that came from India. I think the prices rose. That's as much all I know. But I don't think there probably was not much else happening. I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. I don't, they're probably really complaining, and I mean, in like every country. But there's a certain, no, if you like really focus on impermanence, you know it's going to go again. It's going to change again. I think that's, I wonder sometimes about that. You know, I hear many people say in our culture, especially now with this presidential election circus that's been bombarded with already for a long time and have to go another half year, I think. And the concerns are getting stronger because, you know, it's becoming more manifest, whatever was going on becoming more manifest, and it's a very delicate situation. And part of me feels like, again, too, that in this situation, that we need any prayer and any activity, you know, any votes or any going out to encourage voters or any political activity that we can for the good. And at the same time, we also need to not care about it and not care about the outcome. And I can really see how that's important, because if we care too much, then we lose the contact with creativity. We need any creativity that we can to be really responding to the dynamic that's unfolding. It's becoming, you know, whatever your story is about what it is, but it seems a very dynamic story of how it's being displayed in the media. And so to keep our minds fresh, and to pray for the good seems to be a good response to A, not drown in the whole drama, but also to be able to act unprecedented. Because I think though what I hear in your question, the search for how to stay loving in crisis needs an unprecedented creative mind, I would say.
Yeah. So when I do devotional practice, like, you know, just the short bow out here at the altar outside as I walk by, or, you know, in front of my home altar, you know, just for that minute, my sort of discursive planning mind stops, and I can fill up the universe with you know, kind of open-hearted awareness that I just kind of stopped and opened my heart a little bit. And that, you know, doing it a couple times a day, or, you know, after sitting in here, it ends up sort of, you know, perfuming that kind of habitual life of, you know, jumping in my car and going to work and fixing the lunch. And that's, you know, I'm not stopping any of those things, but they're just framed a little differently when we take these small moments and stop a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I think cause and effect are very real, and every little action counts. So the teachings, and we can go into it in our Dharma discussion at tea and among each other, how all the different ways that we can kind of draw in the reminder to take refuge. Like, we have, you know, all these trappings of a little altars to bow to, or to, at your home, you probably, like you said, you have, when you do lunch, we build up this little, you know, and so Buddha image alone can be a reminder. Like, Buddha images are a great reminder, because just to see a Buddha image alone, there's a certain reference that the image, we give the image, and that what we give to the image comes back to us as a help.
Alan Watts says that if we don't take these little breaks, that we'll just keep winding ourselves
up too tight
and we'll break. So he recommends it just as a way of kind of resetting back to zero.
Yes.
You know, where everything is kind of open and unplanned.
And
we, you know, start winding up too much and too much planning, and it's good to have that little break to reset.
Yeah, and yet with that resetting to, like, drive home again, the sharpness of our teacher's instruction is like, we're not rewinding in order to keep engaging a certain game. We are rewinding because we know there is no solution to the suffering. The words I'm reading here, there's no solution to the suffering of samsara, and samsara cannot be fixed. Like, we're not rewinding in order to do anything out there that needs to be fixing. It doesn't need fixing because it's not broken. There's nothing broken here. We might just not like it. There are no solution to the suffering of samsara. In a way, we can see that in the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There is no solution to suffering. And samsara cannot be fixed. In a way, the Heart Sutra is like a great, like, summary of that. Because it's like, it's not what I think it is. An ear. My ear is not what I think it is. My eyes are not what I think it is. And therefore I'm letting go of it, because it's not what I think it is. You know, there's a certain cutting, a certain change, resetting of priorities that needs to happen in order to make a step into that which we cannot describe.
As you would know, I substitute and have for several years before teaching full-time for any rate. What I do, I always take a mindfulness bell, and I ask how many of the kids are stressed, and they all usually raise their hands. And then I ask them if they notice when they're stressed, and many of them do, and I ask them what they do, and most of them don't have anything they can do right then and there. So Joyce and I have come up with a very simple acronym we did with our kids in Modesto, but it's PBS, but in this case it stands for posture, sitting up straight and tall, so you can breathe, and then you bring to mind who and what you're grateful for, and you smile. Posture, breathe, and smile. And the kids seem to really enjoy it. And whenever things are whacked in the classroom, I just ring the bell and, oh yeah. And I try to do that, and then before I go to sleep at night, I'm always, what am I grateful for that day? And then I keep my hands in just this mudra when I go to sleep, and it seems to really be a good way to start the night.
And then soon you can introduce to yourself the thought that you are not going to live very long and you're going to die.
Well, I like the Tibetan taking advantage of this precious human body.
Yeah.
That image and using it and using it well to receive and give back.
Yeah. For the precious human body, it's a very particular set of contemplation that actually really also focuses on the rarity of hearing the Dharma, and it focuses on the rarity of being able to turn around, making this life meaningful. Why? Because we are easily invested in this life. It's hard to go through the day and not be invested in something, starting with wanting to what I'm going to eat or whatever, and when I'm going to go to the toilet and all these things we're very much invested in, and that drive us, and it's not a negative thing, but it's something to look at. It's something to look at and to be aware about, because we're invested in it.
I love about Buddhist father,
I heard that.
He said pray to the Buddha. Yeah, you know, the Indian, the conceiver.
The conceiver.
Yeah. And I learned from him.
To learn from him, yeah, to pray. Yeah. And it helped you, right? He told stories about how it helped you to pray to the Buddha. Yeah.
He loved the poor people. He, every month, you know, and that's like French colony, every month, 4 days, full moon.
Yeah.
One day before full moon and the other 4 days a month, he give the money to the poor people. Not make money, but money buy something.
Thank you, generous. Yeah, that's great.
And he loved, and that's why he had all the children, you know, play, you know, they come out. Most they come out very good.
Thanks.
Him, and I pray, and after I had my children, they come out very, very good.
Good.
Very good, and love, and happy. So,
They're
very small. They love anything. I have happened, but they love so fast, you know.
For those who don't understand, Lakshmi is sharing, because people in the back might not hear. Lakshmi is sharing how she has been taught by her teacher, your father.
My father.
Who has been very much engaged teaching about Buddha, and that he has been also very generous to the beggars and so forth, and that you have been following his teaching and you have been training your kids, and they came out very well, you said. Thank you for sharing. And we got to go to a tea now. Can I share some more on tea? Thank you for coming today and sharing everything, and I'm sorry if I went over time. Thank you for the newcomers, and love to see you at tea. We're going to have tea next door in a minute. And please keep this conversation going. I'm so glad we have practice period to be able to keep talking about this. Numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.